From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the impact of HMOs on healthcare. We talk with journalist George Anders. He's been writing about business and medicine for the Wall Street Journal. His new book about managed care is Health Against Wealth, HMOs and the Breakdown of Medical Trust. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine reads from his upcoming collection of unselected poems. He says he wanted to bring these poems out of the darkness. And TV critic David Bianculli heralds the return of the HBO comedy The Larry Sanders Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Aviation authorities in India have released transcripts of the conversations involving the pilots of two ill-fated planes and the air traffic controllers minutes before the planes collided a few miles outside New Delhi. Edmund Roy reports.
According to the transcripts released by aviation authorities here, the commanders of both aircraft were aware they were near each other's flight path. Instructions given by air traffic control were confirmed by both pilots. The records also indicate the pilots did not have any idea of the danger before the actual impact itself. The release of the transcript follows suggestions that New Delhi's air traffic control could take part of the blame for the mid-air collision. Government officials have denied such claims, saying air traffic controllers followed correct procedures at all times. Meanwhile, investigators began the process of decoding information from the black boxes recovered from the wreckage. Evidence on the flight data recorders will be placed before a judicial inquiry. For National Public Radio, I'm Edmund Roy in New Delhi.
U.S. Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs Tim Wirth says the United States will soon announce its decision on whether to participate in a multinational force for Eastern Zaire. Wirth says the discussion of the matter is occurring at the highest level of government and the decision will be announced shortly. Wirth is at the United Nations World Food Summit being held in Rome. Meanwhile, the UN says it has reached agreement with rebel authorities in eastern Zaire to allow aid agencies to increase their presence and operations there. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is in Goma. She says relief workers started to distribute some food today, but were stopped by some rebel action.
The United Nations was going about distributing the food that's been held up in Goma for 2 days. They were at the city's main hospital with the food when some shells were fired from the direction of a nearby refugee camp where there are some militia groups fighting the rebels in the area. The shells stopped the distribution of the food. United Nations left the hospital. They were able to come back later in the afternoon and hand out 42 boxes of food.
It's not clear how much food and medicine will eventually get to the refugees. They've been on the move for the last month since fighting broke out between rebels and the Zairean army. Policymakers at the Federal Reserve are meeting in Washington today, but an increase in short-term interest rates is not expected by analysts. The Fed's policymaking body, the Federal Open Market Committee, will make the decision. The group last met in September. It surprised many observers by choosing to let short-term interest rates be. Since that decision, economic data has shown that the economy is slowing down a little. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 18.5 points to 6,247. Trading is active. This is NPR. The Labor Department says that inflation at the wholesale level appears to be well contained. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The Labor Department says its producer price index rose 0.4% in October. That's the biggest price increase since last March. But analysts say it does not signal higher inflation. That's because when the volatile food and energy sectors are removed, the core rate of inflation, the one watched most closely, actually fell 0.3%. Big jumps in the wholesale price of gasoline and heating oil propelled the overall index higher, but drops in the cost of automobiles, prescription drugs, home appliances, and home electronic equipment pushed the core rate lower. For the year, inflation has been well behaved at the wholesale level, with prices rising just under 2.5%, about the same as last year. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
A federal judge will spend the next 3 days deciding who will get to watch a special video transmission of the Oklahoma City bombing trial. U.S. District Judge Richard Mage will choose who will sit in a city courtroom to see a feed of the trial. The trial is being held in Denver. It was moved over pretrial publicity concern. Victims, family members of the dead, and the media all want seats. Judge Mage is also considering disputes over evidence. The defendants, Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, say prosecutors are withholding information, a charge that the prosecutors deny. Weather watchers in the Cleveland area report there's been a lot more snow that has fallen on the city overnight, but it's falling in different amounts in different parts of the city. The National Weather Service says accumulations range from just an inch on the west side in Cleveland to a foot in the northeast suburbs. Total snowfall amounts in the area now range from 1 to 4 feet. Light to moderate snowfall is expected to fall all day between Lake County, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. This is NPR.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. During the presidential campaign 4 years ago, reforming health care was a major issue. The Clinton administration proposed a massive overhaul based on a system of managed care. And even though they failed to get their plan through Congress, the nation is quickly moving away from a system of fee-for-service to managed care. Managed care is seen as an effective way of keeping down the costs of medical care, but according to George Anders, it comes at a price. Anders is a senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal and the author of Health Against Wealth. He believes that managed care is eroding the relationship between doctor and patient and can lead to serious breakdowns in treatment, especially for those with critical health needs. To illustrate one of the problems, Anders begins his book with the story of James Adams, a baby with a high fever.
I think this is really every parent's worst nightmare, is that you've got a very sick infant and you want to get medical care and you're not able to do it. I went down and I talked to his mother, and she had belonged to a health maintenance organization, HMO, and called in the middle of the night to say, what do I do? My baby's got a fever of 104, he's panting, he's moaning. And the answer that she got from a nurse advice line in the middle of the night was, take the baby to Scottish Rite Hospital. It turns out that Scottish Rite Hospital was more than 40 miles away. The mother was on the south end of Atlanta in the suburbs outside the city. Scottish Rite is in the very north end of Atlanta. And she faced a long, lonely drive on a highway. Her husband worked a night job. He had the car. She had to wait for him to come back. They loaded the baby into the car and then headed out down the road, watching the child getting sicker and sicker as the drive unfolded. At one point, the baby stopped breathing. It had a heart attack. They pulled into the first hospital they could find. They did everything they could to revive the baby, but at that stage the baby was suffering from a near-fatal infection. It had overrun the child's whole system, and in the end the only way they were able to save the baby was to amputate both hands and to amputate both feet. It was a horrible, frightening experience for them, and on their drive up to the hospital they had passed three closer hospitals they could have gone to that might have been able to give them care.
What does this story illustrate, then, about the current managed care system? Why begin with this story?
What we've got now is a system that tells people you can't pick any doctor you want, you can't go to any hospital you want, you're going to be part of a health plan that's going to tell you, we're going to make your choices for you. And the marketing of these plans is, don't worry about losing a little bit of control, we're going to make good choices for you. And what I found as I did my reporting is that health plans sometimes don't make good choices for consumers, that they narrow our options and they leave us with long, long drives to get to hospitals and times when we need to get to the first one we can.
As a journalist, is it dangerous, though, to illustrate something with an anecdote? Because one can find an anecdote for almost any point you want to make.
I chose my opening example very carefully because I agree with you. I want to pick an example that's not just arresting, attention-getting, but one that really gets to an important issue. And an important issue for the whole book was emergency care, that most of us sign up for health plans when we're in good health. We don't think we're going to have a medical condition, but something could come along at any time. We could have chest pains and discover we're having a heart attack. We could be parents with a child running a fever. And I felt sort of starting with emergency care and some of the new restrictions that are being put on it was an important message that I wanted to get through in the entire book. So yes, this was a very important way to grab people's attention at the beginning, but I felt that there were a lot of points that I wanted to make, tied to that anecdote all the way through the book.
How much has managed care taken over the health delivery system in this country?
More and more by the week. We've got 58 million people in health maintenance organizations now, and that number is going up at about 150,000 a week. If you throw in preferred provider organizations, which are a looser form of managed care, you're up to about two-thirds of the American populace. And when I talk to industry analysts, they're saying this could be 90% by the year 2000.
As we shift from this fee-for-service system to a managed care system, what do you see as the most significant changes?
One of the first things that we should look at is loss of control for the patient, that you're no longer free to pick a doctor anywhere you want, that you're trusting your health plan. You now have a big friend who's come into your life or a big buddy who's going to tell you, here's how we want things to be done. We also move from a world where the biggest concern of a patient might be over-treatment. Do you really need to run so many tests on me? Are you sure this has got to go in for surgery? To a world where the concern is under-treatment. That doctors are now being paid in very different ways. Sometimes hospitals are being paid in different ways where they get a flat amount of money and they get to keep whatever's left over after they take care of you. So the system now may tilt toward under-treatment, toward saying, well, I don't really think we can operate. I don't really think you need a prescription drug for that. I don't really think you need a test. And patients now have to be concerned, is my doctor doing everything for me that they could be doing?
Under managed care, then, who's calling the shots?
Much more the insurance company, and behind the insurance company, the payers, whether that's the big corporate employer or increasingly the government with its Medicare program for the elderly or the Medicaid program for the poor, that what you've really got is the insurance industry and the payers saying, we're going to take power away from the doctor and the patient. We've got a very major power shift going on in medicine.
How, though, does an insurance company or an overseeing insurance agent make a determination about what an individual patient needs to have? In terms of the process, does the doctor then call up the insurance agent and say, well, I've got Mary Jones in the office and it looks like she's running a fairly high fever. I'd like to run a couple of tests. Do they have to ask permission?
Often they do. I found this fascinating to get inside some of the big HMOs and saying, okay, how do you come up with your rules?
Right.
And in some cases, they will have standard guidelines that, for example, will say, if you're having a mastectomy, this can be done with a one-day hospital stay or with a zero-day hospital stay. Do it as an outpatient procedure. Traditionally, that might have been a two- or three-day hospital stay. They will have formularies for what drugs people can be prescribed, and they will sit with what's the equivalent of a small paperback book, and they will go through, and each drug will have a certain number of dollar signs listed next to it. And drugs with $4 or $5 signs are the most expensive ones, and those can be off-limits. People will be told, I'm sorry, we can't pay for that if you're going to be prescribed that. We want to switch you to a cheaper drug. So what you have now are often HMO headquarters where decisions are made and where they're being done according to the book. The people who write these books go to a lot of trouble to try and make them good, but they don't handle all cases.
Well, who trains the personnel, the people that look up a diagnosis or look up a condition in a book?
The top supervisors are supposed to be MDs in their own right. What I found as I got inside some of the plans is that decisions get delegated down. And in fact, I spent some time looking at one managed care company that was doing mental health services in Rhode Island. And there, most of the moment-to-moment decisions were done by caseworkers without a whole lot of specialized training. So your case is no longer being dealt with by your psychiatrist or your psychologist. It's being bounced over to a case manager who may be someone who's still trying to finish their college degree, who's never met you, doesn't know you, and is seeing a one-page computer printout about you, and is saying, sorry, no more sessions.
Managed care is supposed to be about cutting costs, and you talked about the emergency room ways of trying to limit the consumer's use of the emergency room as a way of cutting costs. And yet you write that many executives who run some of these HMOs are making millions of dollars. Explain how that works.
This really surprised me. When I started writing about managed care, my feeling was this is a philosophy of austerity, and it probably holds top to bottom. And in fact, at one time it did. The people who ran Kaiser, the America's biggest HMO, had a corporate culture where you didn't pay the top management very much, where if you used up a pencil, you had to bring in an old pencil stub before you'd get a new one. And their feeling is, we're going to try and stretch a dollar as far as we can at the bedside, and we're going to stretch a dollar as far as we can in administration. That all began to change in the mid-1980s, that what we had happening was a lot of the big HMOs started to go public. They sold stock, they got a listing on Wall Street, and they began to have a new constituency that they wanted to serve, which were big institutional investors. And for that audience, the best thing you can do is hold down your medical spending, retain more of your earnings, either for dividends or for increasing the stock value of the company. And once we've got that going on, then suddenly the old ethos of, you know, stretch a dollar as far as you can in administration disappears. Now we've got HMO executives who I found have gone and put private golf courses next to their homes, who've bought professional sports teams. One of them owns an NHL hockey franchise, who've bought 14-bedroom homes in the middle of ski resorts in Colorado. I don't begrudge anyone the right to live well. I mean, this is America. It's a free country.
I was just going to say that. This is America.
But at the same time, if you're talking about trying to provide health care for as many people as possible, if you're trying to convince doctors and patients, you're going to have to learn to get by with a little bit less. I think there's something repugnant about the symbolism here, that the feeling is austerity is for the people outside the moat, but once you get to the lord of the manor inside the moat, you're entitled to have as much as you want.
Even if you took all the money that these wealthy CEOs are making and distributed it among healthcare providers, it wouldn't really improve or change the quality of healthcare. You're saying it's a more symbolic situation than a financial one.
Exactly. And I think it becomes very immediate when health plans go to doctors and say, we're going to give you a pay cut. We're not going to be able to reimburse you at the level you used to. And their question is, why? I'm working hard. I'm trying to help my patients. I'm a better doctor this year than I was last year. And if the answer that they see is so that top management can get multimillion-dollar pay packages, I think that makes them very uncomfortable with managed care. And I think even for patients, that if you're told there's a new drug out that can help you against multiple sclerosis, there's a new drug out that can help you against other diseases, but we may not be approving it for you, you'd sure not like to be in a position where you see that the health plan executives are getting the money that you feel you could have had.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break before we talk some more. And my guest is George Anders. He's a senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal, and he's just come out with a book that looks at the managed care system in this country. It's called Health Against Wealth. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. George Anders is my guest. He's a senior special writer for the Wall Street Journal, and his latest book is called Health Against Wealth, and it looks at HMOs, managed care systems in this country. I know that HMOs are signing up the elderly, and this is really a shift in the delivery of health care service in this country. But my assumption is that elderly patients require more expensive care. We spend more of our health dollars towards the end of life than we do at any other time. Why would an HMO, which wants to cut costs and keep costs in line, why would they want an elderly patient?
They get paid more. The federal government has a special pay scale for HMOs that are willing to take members age 65 and over. And in some particularly high-paying markets, such as Los Angeles and Miami, the HMO may get more than $600 a month. By comparison, a single person under age 65, their premiums may be only $120 or $150 a month. So if you get four times as much money coming in, you're able to deliver double the care, triple the care, ideally four times the care, but certainly more care than if you're earning only the premium for a healthy younger person.
How would you say the elderly fare then under managed care?
You know, it's the same classic split that you get for the under 65 population. If people are in pretty good shape and have only modest medical needs, they get a pretty good package. HMOs will generally provide some prescription drug benefits, which are not available to people in a conventional Medicare plan. They'll do a good job of coordinating care so that if you go in the hospital, they'll line up your home health care for you afterward. If you need some physical therapy, they'll help coordinate that. The real problem arises if people get very sick. And that's especially true in the Medicare population. You have this huge split where 90% of people age 65 and over run up Medicare bills of at most $1,000, $2,000 a year.
Yeah.
The last 10% end up running up bills of, you know, easily $30,000 a year. So for those people, the truly sick, That's where the managed care philosophy really starts to fray. And then the cost cutting begins to bite. In the book, I tell the story of several people who had suffered strokes. And if you've ever been with someone who's had a stroke, you know that it's a long, slow process to rehabilitate, that sometimes a lot of function can come back, but it's not easy. And when it comes to things like a person being able to walk again, being able to speak clearly, having their memory come back, it takes a lot of rehabilitation to make that happen. And sometimes managed care plans will take a very hard line and say, I'm sorry, 10 days of rehab and that's it, you're out of here.
Hmm. What do you think are the most important changes then that need to happen with the managed care system?
I think this is going to be a more regulated industry, and I think that's good. If we look at what's happened in the past year, we've already had maternity stays come through Congress, and we had quite a controversy over health plans that were trying to have new mothers leave the hospital after 24 hours rather than the traditional 48 hours, which the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends as the safe and proper standard. So we had Congress step in and say, no, we are going to require 2 days coverage. We think that's the right way to do, and we think the insurance industry just overstepped itself. I think there will probably be other areas that will come up where managed care may go too far in its hunt for cost savings, and government has to look over its shoulder and say, wait a sec, we didn't want you to do that. This is inappropriate. Let's pull back. So regulation, I think, would be the first area that we would have to address. The other would be to get really everyone sitting around the table. That we had 30 years of the American medical system run by doctors alone, and we got some glorious breakthroughs. We got some really good care, but we also had costs going through the roof. We're now in the midst of a period where insurance companies and employers seem to have total command, and that's getting costs down, but that's starting to limit access and really hurt the quality of care people get. And what I'd like to see is a system where we can put everyone around the table, regulators, doctors, payers, providers, and end up with a system that we all believe in rather than one where we've got different forces tugging against each other as hard as they are now.
Well, you know, 4 years ago, the presidential election concluded, and that election was all about health care. It was really the cornerstone of that campaign. Now, 1996 just concluded a presidential election, and not a peep out of either the White House or Bob Dole or anyone else about reforming the healthcare system. Where did that issue go among politicians?
I suspect it's going to come back. In fact, we had a few stirrings on that issue. We had the Kennedy-Kassenbaum bill, which got passed last year, which gives people more portability of insurance. If they switch employers, they don't have to start from square zero again. And the Clinton administration is talking about setting up a health care commission that will look at some of the changes of managed care and whether HMOs are a force for good or a problem area. So I think the administration learned its lesson from the 93-94 debacle that you can't fix health care top to bottom with one giant bill. The subject is just too complicated. There are too many interest groups, and there's too much of a risk that if you try and change everything, you make it worse instead of better. But I think the administration is willing to come back and take a more incremental, gradual approach and say, okay, let's target this one particular area. Let's figure out how to get more of the working poor into some kind of health insurance. Let's target a couple medical conditions, whether it's mental health or maternity stays or emergency care, and figure out how can we make the insurance industry do a little bit more to take care of people. So I think you will see a series of smaller bills. You'll see some initiatives coming out of the administration itself that don't have to go through Congress. This is not an issue that's going to go away. When you do opinion polls and ask people what matters to you the most, healthcare, crime, education, you rotate those three issues, and those are really the top concerns of all of us.
George Enders, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
George Enders is a senior special writer for The Wall Street Journal and is the author of Health Against Wealth. Tonight, after a year off the air, Gary Shandling's HBO comedy series, The Larry Sanders Show, returns with new episodes. TV critic David Bianculli says it's worth the wait, even if he hated waiting.
Maybe in a way, more of TV's best shows ought to take a year off every now and then. We might not take The Simpsons for granted if we had to do without them for a while. And we might support homicide life on the street a little more if we feared it might vanish from primetime. Which, with the rating it gets, is always a possibility anyway. The reason we didn't get any new episodes of The Larry Sanders Show last season is because Shandling decided to take some time off and work on movies. He made one film, Love Affair, with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. He wrote another one, about an alien from outer space who visits Earth and gets married, but never liked it enough to film it. He's still working on it, but finally decided to make some more Larry Sanders episodes in the meantime. Well, all I can say is, welcome back. No other comedy on television dares to present its characters as unflatteringly and as honestly as The Larry Sanders Show. Shandling's Larry Sanders, a popular but insecure late-night TV talk show host, is the focus of the show, but he's not the hero. He's way too warped and worried and two-faced to be considered any type of TV role model. There's also Rip Torn as Artie, Larry's producer, a kind of Bob Haldeman of showbiz, ready and more than willing to please and protect his boss at every opportunity. Torn just won an Emmy for his work on last year's batch of Larry Sanders episodes, and deserved it. But for that matter, Jeffrey Tambor, another Larry Sanders cast member, would have deserved it too. He plays Hank, Larry's talk show sidekick. On the air, Hank is sweet and kind, like Ed McMahon or Willard Scott. Off the air, there's hardly anything he says that doesn't have an obscenity attached. These three characters are the core of The Larry Sanders Show, but they're by no means all of it. The other supporting players are terrific, and the guest stars only get to be guest stars on this show if they're willing to have a little fun, usually at their own expense. In tonight's show, for example, Jon Stewart is preparing for his week as guest host while Larry goes on vacation. The network is really high on Stewart and wants his shows to do well. But Artie and Larry, who fear Stewart as a threat if he does too well, line him up with a guest list that makes that unlikely to happen. In this scene, John visits Larry and reads the proposed lineup on the bulletin board.
Looks like you got a pretty good week here.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. I'm going to talk to Brent Musburger about ABC and then talk to Zsa Zsa Gabor about Brent Musburger and then just ride that crest right into Charles Nelson Reilly.
Right.
And I'm going to hang myself with my own shoelaces.
Then there's another subplot where Larry worries that one of his close friends, David Duchovny, is getting too close for Larry's comfort. Larry begins to suspect that Duchovny is gay and coming on to him. And the X-Files crew jacket he sends as a gift doesn't help.
Ooh, this is nice. Wow. You want to try it on?
The truth is out there? What does that mean?
It's from the show.
What it means is that The Larry Sanders Show is back and hasn't lost a beat. Don't miss it, and don't take it for granted.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a conversation with poet Philip Levine. He's probably best known for his collection of poems, What Work Is, about blue-collar workers in Detroit where he lived and also worked as a young man. Those days continue to be a subject of his poems. We'll talk with him, and he'll read from his upcoming collection of poetry called Unselected Poems. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Philip Levine has won many awards, including 2 National Book Awards and a Pulitzer Prize for his poetry. Praise for his compassionate and honest writing about working-class life, and for mingling realism with romanticism, he's considered one of the country's finest poets. His books include What Work Is, The Simple Truth, New Selected Poems, and a sort of autobiography called The Bread of Time. While many of his poems have earned him praise and fame and a living, he's written others that have been less widely received. Levine decided to collect these poems and put them together in a new book called Unselected Poems, which will be published next year. Let's begin with one of these lesser-known poems called Asking.
Once in the beginning, on the last Sunday of a lost August, I sat on the Canadian shore of Lake Huron and watched the dark clouds go over, knowing this was the end of summer. There was a girl beside me, but we barely knew each other. And so we sat in our separate thoughts, or I did anyway. I saw how it would be summer after summer, working toward a few days like this, when I came flushed with strength and money, my hands scarred and hardened, my shoulders and arms thick, and maybe I would find a girl, or maybe I'd get drunk and fight, or growing older, just get drunk and sit alone staring into a glass the way my uncles did. When I felt the girl's hand on the back of my neck, I shuddered, the way you do when a cool wind passes over you. And she misunderstood and pulled her hand away. I took her hand in mine and said something about having drifted off and how odd it was to know a season had ended at one moment and I had turned toward winter, maybe a lifetime of winters. Then I thought of her, working week after week in the office of a small contractor she said she hated, and going home to the father she said she hated, and the mother, who went on about marriage and was she ever going to get out, and she just barely 22. Almost 30 years ago, she and I never saw each other after we got back to Detroit in the smoky light of early evening. I let her out a block from her house and said I'd call her, but knew I wouldn't, knowing what I did about her life and how she needed someone I wasn't. I went back to my room and sat in the dark, wondering, how can I get out? I knew there must be millions of us, alone and frightened, feeling the sudden chill of winter, of time gathering and falling like a shadow across our lives, wondering what was the answer. Only a boy, still alone, still solemn, turning in the darkness toward manhood, turning as the years turned imperceptibly, petal by petal, closing for the night, the question still unanswered, that question never to be asked again.
And that's Philip Levine reading a poem called Asking, and it's in his forthcoming book of poems called Unselected Poems. What's the story behind that poem?
I think there are a lot of stories. It's one of them I left out of the poem because it didn't belong. One of them had to do with a particular meeting with a young woman. I left out of the poem, it just occurred to me as I was reading it, I left out of the poem the fact that the reason she hated the boss that she worked for was because he was a Jew.
Hmm.
And she started then to go off on an anti-Semitic rant. and I didn't have the nerve to say, you know, do you know the guy you're sitting with and spending the weekend with is of that noble tribe? That was part of it. But I think what hit me the strongest was that this was an experience that I had had several times. Not the part about her anti-Semitism, but the part about a year ending at the end of summer. And it meant, for example, at times it meant that I wasn't going to do what other young people were going to do. I wasn't going to go off to college. I was going to go back to work. I was in that my life, and you know, I'm already a college graduate, but I'm a factory worker, and I'm still going on with a life that doesn't seem to have any future whatsoever. And so I see ahead of me a series like this that will never end. And I think, too, that I'm aware that at this moment in one's life, or say, I don't know when it is, when you're about 14 or 15 up until your early 20s, you ask a great many questions about life. I mean, you really think there are answers, and you think it's central to being a human, to ask these questions and to search for the answers. And I think I'm catching this young man, especially at that point where he's aware not only of the fact that there are questions that may have answers and it's necessary to ask those questions, but that he lives in a world of people, all of whom have these questions and none of whom are getting satisfactory answers. They can get answers. They can go Sunday morning to church and they'll get answers about their duty to God and how they will suddenly change and they will be saved, et cetera, et cetera. And I knew that there were places where I could get these answers, but I had already tried that and they didn't work for me. I had somehow to answer them in some other way.
Well, you ask, how can I get out? And that seems to be one of the questions that really drives a lot of your poetry about this time, and perhaps even realizing that there is a world out there beyond the factories of Detroit. But how the heck do I get out of here?
Yes. Yeah. That was... I didn't know. I mean, I had a BA in English from Wayne University, you know, which was, I don't know what it is now, but it was a second-rate school. But like a lot of second-rate schools, it had a lot of wonderful teachers. I learned a lot about literature. I mean, I cared a lot about literature. I studied aesthetics. I mean, these are marvelous things to take into the marketplace. People are just dying to, you know, talk about Kant's aesthetics. And so here I was a very well-educated person with nothing to do, right? I had my BA, big deal. I had tried advertising. I spent a day in an advertising agency.
That was enough.
This stuff, yeah, that people said this stuff is wonderful. I never went back. I just couldn't imagine doing this.
Right.
I mean, I just didn't think it made people spiffier to have Buicks and, you know, Pontiacs. And I mean, in Detroit, most of the advertising was for automobiles. And I found it an appalling thing to do. I also had the feeling, which was might have been romantic in a way, and yet I think there's a truth, that it was dangerous if I were going to be a writer to misuse language, to purposely misuse language, to purposely use it for lies, that if I were to do that, then language would avoid me, the language that I needed so badly to be the poet I hoped to become.
Have you ever thought about what your life would have been like if you hadn't, as you write about, entered poetry? And this is entered poetry as a young boy. But what would that, were you totally destined to be a poet, you think?
Yes. I don't think anything could have stopped me. I remember at about age 6, my older brother said to me, I don't remember exactly what I said, but he said, he was stunned by my expressiveness, that I had said it so well. I remember as a very young kid, my teachers being just shocked by my articularity and by my papers that I wrote. When I started college, my intention was to become an engineer. I didn't even know what an engineer was. But somehow it seemed, you know, let's have a profession. My older brother went to college for a whole semester. He was the first one in our family ever to go to college. And then he went into World War. He got drafted into the Army and went into World War II. And so I thought, well, I'll go to college. One of us will become a college graduate. I'll be an engineer. That's spiffy. Then I broke my forearm. Putting up storm windows, I remember. So I went to my teacher and told him, you know, I can't finish this class in mechanical drawing. I've got this broken arm. Can I just drop the class? He said, no, you'll have to flunk. And I said to myself, I don't want to live with people like this. You know, these aren't my kind of people. Somebody with so little heart that he's just going to flunk me with my broken arm.
Well, that was a good thing.
It was a good thing. It really was. I mean, I was writing poetry at the time and not sharing it as much as I might have. And the important thing, I was entering college and I was suddenly discovering, I mean, I was in my first semester, I was suddenly discovering modern poetry. And it excited the hell out of me. The way no poetry had ever excited me before. And I just couldn't get enough of it. The decision to become a poet, you know, was not like what happens in a Bergman movie. You know, I mean, there was no morning when I woke up and, you know, went to the eastern windows and the sun broke and I said,
poetry.
Now I know what I'm going to do. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a poet. No, it was really a decision that was made day by day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just kept doing this and I kept doing it and liking it more and loving it more and needing it more. And in my second semester at Wayne, I had a teacher who said to me, who told me, we wrote this long sort of investigative paper and I did okay on it. And then we had, and our reward for completing that paper was to write a personal essay of like 30 pages or something. And I wrote a personal paper on what the universe would, what America would look like, the world would look like politically if I were in charge. And the guy asked me to stay after class. And he said to me, I saw him holding the paper and there were these little red marks for misspellings and mispunctuation. I thought, uh-oh. And he said to me, I hate your politics. You're really an anarchist. You know that, don't you? I didn't. And he said, you're really an anarchist, and I'm very conservative politically. But, you know, I was convinced by this paper. You write much better than I do. And I said, what do you mean? Look at all those mistakes. And he said, no, that's nothing. That's what I do well. But I can't, and he read me a couple sentences. He said, I can't do this. You should become a writer. And I don't know who the hell, his name was John Sinclair. I don't know what became of the man. But it was an enormous affirmation for me to get it from a guy I considered a sort of knowledgeable person. I suddenly said, as an 18-year-old, I said, hey, maybe this is possible.
Maybe I can be a poet.
Yeah.
Poet Philip Levine. He's got a forthcoming book of poetry coming out next year called Unselected Poems. Levine has received a Pulitzer Prize and two National Book Awards for his poetry. He's currently teaching at NYU. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Philip Levine is my guest, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, won the Pulitzer Prize for a book of poetry called The Simple Truth. He's also won the National Book Award for a book of poems called What Work Is, and also a book of poems which came out back in 1979 called Ashes. He has a forthcoming book of poetry called Unselected Poems, and he's currently teaching poetry at New York University. Well, I know you have a twin brother, and I wonder what path he took. I mean, if you live parallel lives in any way.
We did for a while. At that time, he wanted to be a painter, and he enrolled. His grades were worse than mine, so he couldn't go to Wayne University. He went to Highland Park Junior College. He did a year there. And then he came to Wayne, and he got into the art department there and was doing very well. And then, like many young men will do, he fell madly in love, and that sort of sidetracked him. He wanted to get married, and to get married he needed money, and then he had a child, and then he had to support the child, and painting sat untended, undone, probably until his 40s.
Hmm.
When he decided, the hell with it, I'm going back to painting. So he's painting now, and he's painting very well. And I think if he has the luck, he's now, of course, he's my age, he's 68. So he's been painting for 20-some years and getting better and better. If the world wants to discover a terrific 68-year-old painter, his name is Edward Levine, and he lives in Detroit.
Does he look like you? I know you were identical twins at birth, but sometimes when people age, the changes can
our voices are identical.
Yeah.
He's a bit heavier than I am, but you wouldn't have any trouble knowing he was my identical twin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we still look plenty alike.
Are you close?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's very dear to me.
You worked at the Chevrolet gear and axle plant in Detroit.
Yes.
And I read somewhere that you got a job there because you had some gambling debts you had to take care of.
I don't know where you read that. It's not true.
Is that right? It was that you had, it's funny how you can read things about people.
Yeah.
That these were gambling debts from the racetrack?
Oh. Well, no. I paid my gambling debts from the racetrack. I mean, in order to bet, I would go to the track because I was mad for horse racing.
Is that right?
And for many years, I worked for a woman named Lucky Lottie Wolf who owned horses in Detroit. And I would be her gopher. I'd drive her around, be her gopher, do this and that, and place bets for her. And I got hooked and started betting all my money. So I would work all summer, and sometimes I'd work a night job, and then I'd drive her around. And I went to the track every day.
Really?
And worked for her and worked on another job. And the summer would come to an end, and I wouldn't have a dime, you know, because, I mean, I just wouldn't. I just wasn't as smart. A smart bettor doesn't go to the track. He says there are better things to do with your money than blow it on these ridiculous odds and these rigged races, because a lot of the races were rigged.
But
only time I ever won money was when I knew it was a boat race.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was married to a woman who was utterly useless and expensive. And fortunately, she divorced me and went on to torture other men. And then I found a marvelous woman who was beautiful and immensely useful and loving. So my life changed radically about age 26. I mean, I lost the one wife at age 24, thank God, and married the other woman at 26.
So a useful woman saved your life?
A useful woman saved. She supported me for a while I wrote poetry, yeah.
Yeah. When you were gambling, did you get into that whole gambling mindset, which is just, you know, just one more race, just one more thing I'm going to bet on, and then my luck will change. Then I'll have what I want.
No. I knew I would go on betting. I mean, I just, first thing, I love the races. I love the horses, and I love seeing them run. And it was, even when I won, I mean, I don't think I ever said to myself, one more race. No, it was always many, many, many more races. This is the life I like. It was full of color. It was full of life. It was full of crazy people. It was a wonderful, rich world. I mean, you see it in Sherwood Anderson. He has some wonderful stories about a racetrack and the animals and the men and women who work around animals. And I just love that world.
Yeah. Have you written poems about that world?
I did. I'm working on two poems about that world. I started them this summer. They're not done yet, but I think they're pretty good. Yeah.
And whatever happened to the lady you drove around? Lucky
Lottie?
Lucky Lottie.
My assumption is she's probably not alive anymore. She already had heart troubles. Actually, she bought the horses and went into the horse racing thing. Because her doctor said she needed a distraction. She had heart trouble. She was immensely overweight, smoked like a chimney. And so the distraction she gets is horses, right? I mean, not too smart. Yeah.
Good prescription, perhaps.
Yeah.
When you were working at the gear and axle factory, you worked the night shift.
Yes.
Was that so that you could free yourself up during the day to write poetry? Was the idea that, you know, I'll pay the bills this way, and I'll be a poet at that time of the day.
It had two motives. One was, yes, exactly that. And the other was to keep my wife and me apart. This was my first wife. The best thing we could do is not be in the bed at the same time.
Did you know that early on in this marriage?
I knew it after a year that I should either work afternoons or I should work nights, because the less we saw of each other, the better chance we had of being happy together.
Mm. And yet she divorced you.
Yeah, she divorced me with me cheering her on. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. I mean, we agreed it was time to get a divorce, and she met a guy who had a lot of money, and so she saw suddenly she had a little extra motivation there. Yeah. And she married this guy with a lot of money.
Poet Philip Levine is our guest. We'll talk more in just 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to poet Philip Levine. He's got a forthcoming book of poetry called Unselected Poems due out next year. You've described inspiration as an extraordinary level of concentration. Do you have rituals, things that you try to do to get yourself to that spot? Are you patient enough to wait?
I wait. The only thing I've discovered is I know how to stop myself from achieving that extraordinary concentration. I mean, Keats and Coleridge both described themselves as though they had been seized by a force outside themselves and almost given poems. Keats, as I recollect, is talking about the Eve of St. Agnes, which you can see in manuscript form in the Houghton Library at Harvard. He obviously rewrote lots of it. Right. It wasn't the way he describes it. I think we like to lie about how we write our poems, how easy it is when it's a lot of work. But I know certain things I can do to stop that kind of thing. I mean, I can, you know, if I'm really hungover in the morning, there's much of a chance that I'm going to be writing a good poem. In one of Lillian Hellman's autobiographical books, Dashiell Hammett, who she's living with, says to her she hasn't been able to write anything. And she's complaining about this writer's block, and Dashiell Hammett says to her, "Lillian, if you would just put your ass on a chair and sit in front of a typewriter, you would write." Yeah.
Well, I know that you teach now. You're teaching at NYU, and I actually read a quote from a student, I think you were teaching at Vassar, who called you the cruelest man she had ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And you were, I guess, teaching a poetry class.
Yeah.
Are you a taskmaster as a teacher? You think it's your job to do that?
Well, I know one of my jobs. I mean, right now there are 14 students in my class at NYU, and I make 15. So there are 15 people in the room. One of them is being paid to tell the truth. The others can butter each other up. But somebody has to deliver the news that, say, X is going nowhere. Y can't make two words on a page seem happy to be there. And D is writing poems that were already written by Sharon Olds. I mean, somebody's got to come in there and tell them. And I'm the person who's been entrusted with that.
Do you sugarcoat that at all? Or
no.
You tell it like it is?
I try not to be cruel. I try to encourage them when they're gifted. And I have right now some very gifted people. But I don't believe in turning away from it. I think you have mm-hmm. to say it. Let's face it. How many of these people are going to go on to be poets? Maybe these three that I've hit on that I think are really enormously gifted, maybe they will go on. But a lot of things can derail even them. Bad luck, dumb marriages, the kind of thing that I did. Or good luck might help them. Maybe they don't finally have enough of a story to tell about the world. Maybe they don't want it as badly as I wanted it. So somebody has to be there to say, well, one of the things we are teaching is how the hell to read and to read carefully and to make demands on poetry, to make the most demands we could.
Well, speaking of poems, I'd love to have you read one more poem for us.
This one is called Salt. This one woman has been sobbing for hours. The last plane is gone, and no one is left except the porter mopping the floors and an old woman cleaning out the ashtrays and wiping the chrome handles of the chairs. No one has asked her to leave because there are no more flights, and even the cop down the tiled hall has fallen asleep. The plane has by now entered the night somewhere between Chicago and Cleveland, and below the lights of cities are going on and off, or perhaps there are cloud banks, or perhaps the man in the window seat is blinking his eyes. Soon they will pass over water. No one will think, thus did the angel of death before he descended upon Egypt, only to find the Egyptians. Though many will think of death as the darkness below. One or two may pray to enter it. Tonight, while there is still time to die all at once in a great jellied ball of fire, brief stars torn from their orbits. Landing, the passengers scatter in all directions and disappear into the city in cabs, on buses, in subway cars. Some find someone waiting and walk whispering, arm in arm, toward the car. One man stands in the faint drizzle and puts on his raincoat and hat. If he hurries, he can be home by dinner, and he and his kids can watch television until one by one they fall asleep before the set and dream of those dark stretches that redeem nothing at all, or of the rain that hangs above the city, swollen with red particles of burned air. One of them, perhaps the father, may even dream of tears, which must always fall, because water and salt were given us at birth to make what we could of them. And being what we are, we chose love. And having found it, we lost it over and over.
Philip Levine, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mari.
Philip Levine is a forthcoming book of poetry due out next year called Unselected Poems. He's currently teaching at NYU. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.